Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. I have another repeat guest. In fact, I think Glenn Fleischman, who is my guest, is this is his three-peat, the rare three-peat. Glenn, Ooh. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. I am a pretty random guest, though, I have to say. I think my behavior proves that.
It is true. I was toying with introducing you as the Kevin Bacon of podcasting. But then I worried that Kevin Bacon had a podcast and he would get upset. So, and I didn't want to Google if he did or not because I'm a lazy man.
Six decibels of separation from Kevin Bacon's podcast.
That's right. But Glenn, tell the people. I have a hard time believing that someone who's listening to this may be unfamiliar with you, but it could be the case. So tell the people a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a technology journalist and I have a great time writing about all kinds of wacky stuff, as well as, you know, I do like reviews of USB-C battery packs for Macworld, but I've also been trying to develop more of a specialty writing about kind of like little quirky, interesting things. Like I have a story in preparation about a font detective. He's a guy who's a type designer, but he also testifies regularly, like all the time, about font forgeries and like document forgery based on his typographic. It's like a great TV show idea. You'd have to put more murders in, but he's... He has all this incredible depth of knowledge about the history of type, as well as knowing hundreds and hundreds of typefaces and also printing techniques. So you're like, well, that could be a Murder, She Wrote, you know, kind of show.
It may have been. And I bet that's a pretty sweet gig. I imagine it's quite lucrative to be an expert.
Well, I've seen his price list and it's pretty amazing. Yeah. But I do that. I write about like printing history and technology. I'm working right now on the history of typewriters, just a short article, which is a subject that fascinates me. But I discovered the same person who inspired the creation of, or helped test, like a beta tester of the first practical typewriter in the 1860s, also is the person responsible for the creation of the Linotype typesetting system. Bum, bum, bum.
talk about detective work.
Anyway.
The call is coming from inside the house.
That's right. This was well known at the time, but I'm only now hearing about it.
Well, so,
that's the kind of thing I write about. And I'm currently letterpress printing a book just to...
Just keep it interesting.
Yeah. Exactly.
Now, I have seen people can order your book. Is that right?
They can order the book. They can order... I have a keepsake style thing that's like a poem by Walt Whitman about type, because Walt Whitman was a printer. He started his career at 13, of course, as you would, as a printer apprentice. And it's a poem called A Font of Type. And I printed the poem on a letterpress, but also an essay explaining the history of Whitman and typesetting and that day in the 1800s and what the poem means, because the poem is full of obscure printing and typesetting stuff. So people read this poem are like, oh, how beautiful, but most of the terms are meaningless after like 1920. So I was fascinated by that.
Ah, well, there'll be a link in the show notes for folks to purchase said item and learn all about that poem and gaze upon your letterpress loveliness.
Oh, the beauty.
Now, we're not here to talk about letterpressing or any of the various esoteric subjects that you love, Glenn.
There is a shocking paucity of printing in Star Trek, I will tell you.
It is. They have gone past the printed word, which is actually not true, because in one of the, I think, DS9's best episodes, The Visitor, I think it's called The Visitor. Someone right now is going to send me an angry email, where Jake Sisko, we see old Jake Sisko and he's, you know, a successful novelist. He is surrounded by his books in print.
Oh, yeah. I like that episode. I remember that episode. That's great. I know we're not talking about that today. I'm going to have to go watch that episode. That's fantastic.
It is a really good episode. We, Maurice and I are doing, well, I'm doing a rewatch of Deep Space Nine and she is kind of watching it for the first time. Although thanks to this podcast, she has seen some episodes of DS9 in random order. So we have I bring that up because we just skipped over watching that episode again because we had just seen it recently. But it is a great episode. Not the episode that we watched, though, but we'll get to that in a second. It is The Collaborator, Season 2, Episode 24. Interesting episode of Deep Space Nine. Interesting episode of Star Trek, because generally episodes of Star Trek have multiple storylines going on at the same time. You have an A plot, you have a B plot. The B plot's usually, depending on what the A plot is, some kind of, you know, like, you know, I don't know, Chief O'Brien has locked a wrench in sickbay and Julian has to help him get it out or something, you know, a little wacky light thing.
It turns out that wrench is the only way to keep the ship from, or the space station from being destroyed.
That's right. And then the A plot is where, you know, all the action is happening, the real meat of the story. This story, The Collaborator, nothing but A plot. There is no B plots. It is all Bajoran religion all the time.
Yeah, it sort of makes use of points of view. So there's the A plot, right? There's only an A plot, but there's like these visions that serve visions. As almost mm-hmm. a B plot style, because it's a separate, not analogy, what's the word, like a metaphorical, they are more dreamlike than visions, but I guess he's having information conveyed to him that's right. accurate in this kind of allegorical prophets. Form. That's what I'm
saying. Yes, there you go. Yes, because the prophets, he is kneeling before the orbs, and the prophets are sending him visions. The prophets being very aware of production costs always come in the guise of actors they've already paid to be in these episodes, on sets they already have prepared for these episodes. But I do think it's effective. I've said this before. That because the prophets, whenever you are encountering the prophets, they are always characters that you know, except they're slightly different. It's very effective. Oh,
I like the whole prophets. Yeah, right. I mean, because they occupy the bodies or they talk mm-hmm. through the vision. This has been my issue about omnipotent beings or beings of pure energy, right? Like across Star Trek and across sci-fi, if you could do anything or be anything, how would you represent that? There's a clever bit in one of the Q episodes in Next Generation. Or is it Voyager? Now I think about it. The one where their Q is standing, they're in the Q continuum, and it's like this barren waste, and someone's reading a newspaper. Is that
that's Voyager?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's that two-parter. So I actually thought it was really effective in that sequence where they're about to fire some weapon, the Voyager crew, and the Q people are like, don't you understand? This is, you know, it's like, this is a representation of a weapon. It's not a cannon. They probably would, you know, they don't say it. It's like, you could supernova entire galaxies with it. And I thought, there's a great thing when you're saying, yes, the human brain can encompass this, so we're representing it this way. And I think the conceit in Voyager that the prophets are effectively interacting for whatever reason, we don't totally even understand, I think, even by the end of the series, right? Why exactly they've chosen to interact with human beings, or
they move in mysterious ways.
Exactly. But I love the conceit that they use, that they can't communicate in a linear or sensible way. So this is the closest they can do mm-hmm. to representing something that people can understand. And I think it plays that way because allegory has driven us crazy since the days of the Greeks when the oracle would say nonsense and be like, why don't you just speak straightforwardly? It's like, well, that's not really how we look at the universe. So
that's not my deal. I need I don't understand time the same way you do, which is what and I think so Deep Space Nine is interesting. It has so many big kind of themes that run throughout it. One of the most interesting to me is kind of religion versus science, right? So the mm-hmm. Federation shows up and they're all about science, and the prophets are not prophets, they're wormhole aliens, but they're also very respectful of the Bajorans. So they don't basically say, you know, your entire belief system is crap, but they say, you can believe that, but we're going to keep calling them wormhole aliens, right? And Sisko, of course, is all wrapped up because he's the emissary, but he doesn't really want to be the emissary, but he loves Bajor, and he feels like he has this duty to be the emissary, but he's uncomfortable with it, which none of this is covered in this actual episode, but it's just interesting background to have.
No, but we'll get to that scene that I with Sisko that was so delicious. Yes,
is people who listen to Random Trek know that I am not a huge fan of Bajorans. I do love Kira because I think she's one of perhaps one of my favorite Star Trek characters, period. But the Bajorans in general kind of bore me. There are exceptions, obviously. Kira. The other one is Vedic, or by the end of this, Kai Winn, who is just a fantastic character.
Oh my God, Louise Fletcher mm-hmm. is such – I mean – I feel like it's the creepiest possible, like if you took 100 other actresses who are also very good actresses and stuck them in that role, no interpretation could be as chilling, and nuanced as it, because even as she's lying, you understand that she is in this complicated relationship between seeking power, but also trying to do good. It is not, I mean, no, as the show, we're in season two here. By the time you get to the end of Deep Space Nine, that has changed. I'm not going to say that. But at this point, there is that character has a long and interesting arc, and I don't know how much the the folks who created the show intended for her to go that direction, like how far plotted out they had this whole thing, except for the very end kind of revelation. But she is not, I mean, she's not just pure evil.
No.
She's not just after power. And there's very few characters in all of Star Trek who are not, you know, who have that much complexity to them, I want to say.
And I think most of them, if you find characters like that in Star Trek, they're going to be in Deep Space Nine almost person, right? So you've got Kai, who is obvious, Kai Winn, who is like that. Gul Dukat is psychotic, but also
wonderful.
He lives by his own code, which is kind of weird, but Quark. Another one of Shades of Grey with Quark is where he lives. Less evil than, of course, the company that I list in his other the other characters, but certainly a scoundrel.
He's like lawless neutral or something.
is true. And Odo, I think, also Odo has a very rigid code of conduct, but he follows his code and his code only, and generally it aligns with other people's, but when it doesn't, he is not bending. So
what's the I can't remember his name. Is it Alim Garak? Is that the right name?
Garak, yes.
Mm-hmm. Garak. Oh yeah, that's what he's called, Garak. I love that character.
Oh, he is.
You do. And mm-hmm. but and what number of shades? He has 1,000 shades of gray. And he's aware of them all. He's wonderful.
It's true. And he lies about every single one of them.
Yeah.
Even when he doesn't have to. Exactly. Right. But none of those characters appear in this except for Kai Winn.
Quark.
Quark is in it, and Sisko's in it. Sisko is not – Sisko's a great character. He is not as complicated, I feel, as the other kind of one, the big characters. But
it's true.
He has an arc, and he is probably more fleshed out than a lot of the other main characters of Star Trek series.
He's just more realistically angry in a way that's sort of frightening than any other actor in any of the shows.
That is true. And we know more about his personal life than we do. Mm. Like Captain Picard was always kind of captaining, except when he was like on Risa, wearing an inappropriate little outfit. He didn't have much of a personal life. His career was his personal life, but Sisko has a career. He has a family. He's got a lady friend in later seasons, spoiler alerts. And so, you know, he's a man about, he likes baseball, maybe a little too much, but hey, whatever. Whatever floats your boat. But this episode, I've spent a whole lot of time not talking about what happens in this episode.
Oh, sorry. This is a problem with having me on your show. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Episode leaves me many questions, though, because the kind of the central premise is that it is the big election for the Kai, which is, I guess, kind of the Bajoran Pope. And everybody, you know, Burrell, who is in a relationship with Kira, is the clear choice because everybody likes him. He is very spiritual. He's helped out in the occupation. And the previous Kai Apaka, says basically, you should elect Burrell as my successor. He is my chosen one. Kai Winn, Kai Winn, but she's a Vedic in here. Vedic Winn is also in the running. She wants to be Kai. She believes it's, you know, she doesn't say it, but she says she does the work of the prophets and let the prophets, you know, sort it out. But clearly she wants it to happen, right? And there's also a government. There is a government set up on Bajor. So there's a civilian government, but there's also a religion. But the religious – and Kira says that she's going to vote for the Kai. So I'm assuming everybody on Bajor votes for the Kai?
Yeah, that was weird. Right. Well, I don't quite – I mean, there's a secular government. But people defer to the Vedics and Kais in a lot of different ways. Right. And
the Bajorans are very spiritual.
Yeah. So it's not so much that they have soft power because people wouldn't want to cross them. Mm-hmm. But they don't. I don't think they have hard power. I was trying to look up here. I've forgotten when Kai Apaka, she leaves. Is it in the first season even that she gets – she disappears on the other side of the wormhole?
She stays back in the whatever the – I always forget the name of my quadrants wrong, so people get upset with me.
But I've lost track of which episode it is in which she – is it Accession? So that's – yeah, see, I've lost track of when that is because that happens a while ago that she's that she is stuck behind. So they're electing a new Kai because she's gone, but did that just happen here? I forgot.
Yeah, I don't know. It hasn't – there's been a while, and I don't know. Maybe, you know, the the ways of the Bajoran, the Vedic assembly are slow. So,
well, that's what I was thinking. It happened more. Yeah, exactly. I was thinking it happened. Okay.
But, yeah, so she disappears, because she, I forget what happens to her, but she stays behind in,
Oh, she's killed on a planet where, everyone keeps getting revived and there's kind of this endless war, but you have to stay
there.
Oh,
that's right. That's right.
If you leave the planet, you will die. So she decides to stay sort of forever and try to create peace or something like that. Right.
Yes. Because everybody loves her. Everybody loved her. She was, you know, and she was most importantly, so this is an important point. She was the Kai during the Cardassian occupation of Bajor, which is another thing that's so interesting about Deep Space Nine is this story of the Cardassian occupation and how it has had so much impact on the Bajoran people, as one would imagine. And there are many allegories, right? You know, I've had people on, and it's clear that basically Bajorans are space Jews and the Cardassians are Nazis, right? So,
yeah, and it's creepy though, because the Nazis aren't actually defeated. They just go back to their own
they just leave.
Planetary countries and just kind of come and poke every once in a while.
Yes. And so this is what I'm telling you, people. If you're listening to this podcast and you somehow have gotten to this point in your life without seeing any Deep Space Nine.
Oh my God.
You should just stop listening to this podcast. We'll be here when you get back, and just watch all of Deep Space Nine. Just do
it
all.
Scott, I know we haven't talked about the episode much yet, but let me just say, I actually have a plan to rewatch Deep Space Nine because I watched most of it. I think I missed some episodes. And then after they switched over the symbiote actress, I like Terry Farrell quite a bit. I didn't think the replacement was as good and the Quarf thing, whatever. So I lost track. And so many years pass and I've watched episodes here and there. And then I hear people talking about it with such great affection. I start looking back at some of the descriptions. I'm like, oh yeah. Oh, that was really good. That was really new. Oh yeah. That was really great. And I saw Max Temkin posted that like watching guide to DS9 a couple years ago, like how to watch, if you wanted to not speed through it, but if you didn't want to watch every single episode, kind of how to get the whole arc and get the best flavor of it. And I gotta rewatch it. Like it's the only Star Trek that I feel like I really want to go through start to finish and rewatch the whole thing now.
And it really does. So, you know, it was started during when TNG was on the air. Deep Space Nine and TNG were on at the same time for a period of time. And the first two seasons of Deep Space Nine have some very good episodes, but they are not, they weren't, it wasn't clicking. They didn't know what they were doing, really. Towards the middle of the third season, it is clear that they are on track. They have an idea. They know what they're doing. And they have, I think they basically freed themselves from kind of the baggage that is being a Star Trek franchise.
Yeah.
Because they're doing things, they do things that you don't see on any other Star Trek. Like we watched an episode of Deep Space Nine, Little Green Men, where Quark and Rom and Nog go back in time and end up, they crash land in Roswell. And so it's a silly episode. But it made me think, because Worf, spoiler alert for people who have not seen Deep Space Nine, Worf joins the cast. And he has a lot of trouble when he first joins the cast understanding how Deep Space Nine works, because he was used to the Enterprise. And on the Enterprise, if someone like Quark was hanging out, he would just be arrested.
Right, exactly.
Because he's a Star Trek. You don't do that.
Deep Space Nine is the most wonderful compromise of like its Cardassian equipment, which they've sort of taken over, but not entirely. As we know, there's different episodes where the Cardassian hardware and other stuff acts up. They can't really, they're running the space station, but it's sort of at Bajor's cooperation. Bajor hasn't joined the Federation yet. At least I forget. They don't until later, or do they during the show?
Well, and a lot of Bajorans don't want to join the Federation.
Yeah, because, right. It's all, but everything is gray. There's like, and you know, Quark does a lot of good, but he's, you know, he's not really, like I said, he's not really evil. He's just completely self directed. So, it's all, there's nobody who's singularly anything in this, which is Worf's confusion. Well, I don't understand. Everyone should have a single attribute.
That's right. And there are interesting scenes. So, Deep Space Nine lets them set up interesting scenes where you have like three characters, none of which are in the Federation, none of Starfleet officers, and they're all kind of doing what they do, generally complaining about the Federation. And there is, I think, I just watched an episode where Quark and Garak comes to Quark's bar and Quark gives him root beer and says, try this human drink.
Oh, that is the best scene.
It's fantastic.
There's nothing better than that in the whole. Oh my God. I just realized we need like a Bechdel's rule for Star Trek. In this show, it would be like the Bechdel's rule. And it would be when you have two characters, not in the Federation, talking about something together that doesn't involve the Federation.
Mm-hmm. And who are not humans.
We're not humans, right? Oh, that's good.
Yes, but so Deep Space Nine, this is a love fest for Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine is great.
Yes.
This episode is, Glenn, you really like this episode
that we just watched.
I think it's good. I did not like it. I don't think as much as you did. But I do think it's interesting.
So let's you've just been watching later episodes that may explain it. So this is, I think, a really good early two seasons episode.
Yes, it is. It is. And I think that I would say, so I think Max's kind of watch list for the seasons is right on. And I think when he gets to like the fourth season, he basically says, just watch all the episodes. The first three seasons you could skip around, but it's important to watch some of them because as I'm rewatching it myself, you know, they do a really good job of, building the relationships between characters. The characters grow, which is kind of unusual in Star Trek, frankly. Because TNG, while I love TNG, you know, the start of TNG, Picard is Picard. At the end of TNG, Picard is Picard. You know, it just the way it is. But at the start of DS9, Sisko is a completely different person than at the end of Deep Space Nine, which is fantastic. Oh, yeah.
And right, Odo's made massive transformations. Yep. I mean, most of the characters do. I think Odo may have one of the biggest transitions. Bashir is still sort of Bashir. We just know more about
him. Bashir, I don't really like Bashir all that much, but watching him throughout the seasons, he's growing a little bit on me. So it's all right. But this episode, you're right, is a very good early season Bajoran-heavy episode, which is a couple of caveats, I know. But it's good. So it's interesting. So the central premise here is the Kai. There's the big Kai election, which I don't really understand how it works. It's the Pope of Bajor, basically.
Everybody votes for the Pope, apparently.
Everybody votes for the Pope. Okay. The Vedics seem to be bishops or cardinals, but they aren't the only people who vote, I guess. I don't know. It doesn't really matter. So Burrell wants to be the Kai. Everybody seems to think that Burrell's going to be the Kai, except, dun-dun-dun, this guy shows up on Deep Space Nine, and his name is Kobos? Is that how you say it? Kobos?
Yeah, Kobos, I think. Kobos. The name was very, I couldn't even understand what the name was practically when they were saying it. It was funny. They kept saying it. I was like, it's Kuba what? Kuba Snow?
Yeah, it's a difficult name. He shows up and
Kuba's
he's an old
Oak.
That's Kuba's, Kuba's yes.
Oak. I thought they were saying Kuba Soak. I think that was one.
He shows up and someone's like, I know who you are. And you're like, uh-oh, this is trouble. So it turns out, once again, you know, the layer of complexity of Deep Space Nine. So when you have an occupation, you've got people who are fighting the resistance, and that would be, you know, Kira Nerys and a bunch of her friends. You've got people who are oppressed, who are, you know, enslaved, basically, and so that's most of Bajor. And then you've got people who are working with the occupation, which they are known as collaborators in the parlance.
Yes.
And so they have many reasons for doing this. And this is another thing that I love about Deep Space Nine. This guy is clearly a collaborator, but he isn't like a one note character. It's not like he was just kind of a coward. He had his reasons and he was trying to help. And he thought this was the best way to do it. He was wrong, but he thought it was the best way to do it. And so he shows up. Ed Kira, you know, they throw him in the brig because he's basically a war criminal. I think Kira makes mention of like there's some kind of like top 10 war criminals and he's number 4 on the list or something. And so they throw him in the brig and, you know, everybody's upset. And they want to extradite him. In my mind, she's just Kai Wynn, but now in this episode, she's Vedic Wynn at the moment.
Yes. I know. I was confused because I'd forgotten when she became Kai. So I'm watching this going, what?
What's the deal? She meets him and he tells her something.
And she gets to wear the Sydney Opera House in this one. It was great. That's an amazing hat. Her Kai hat is much less interesting than the Sydney Opera House hat.
It is true. It's kind of a downgrade because she goes from the Sydney Opera House to like a little beanie.
Yeah, that's great.
Which is, you know, not so great. But that costume is more elaborate, so I guess that's the upside.
Oh, I see. It's true.
And so she chats with him, and she decides he tells her something. We don't know what he tells her. And she says, all right, you're coming with me to Bajor. Kira is like, he's not leaving this station. And this is so one of my favorite. I mean, I love Kira as a character, and I love when Kira and Wynn interact, because it is, yes. You know, Wynn always calls her my child, which I'm sure super annoys Kira, and is always kind of, you know, wrapping herself in her religion, and making any excuse for whatever she wants by, you know, saying it's the prophet's will, and, you know, I'm just trying to help, and it's great. And I said to Marisa as we were watching this episode that Wynn very effectively manages to wield her religion as a cudgel and just kind of beat people into submission.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what she does, for good or for ill. This episode of Random Trek is brought to you by Casper, an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. Supportive memory foams create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounds. You can even try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Free shipping and returns in the United States and Canada. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress, and I hope it will become your favorite mattress. And to help, we have a special offer. You get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/trek. That's www.casper.com/trek, and using the offer code TREK. Terms and conditions apply. My thanks to Casper for sponsoring Random Trek.
We're forgetting about the, we didn't mention the orb scenes though.
Cause we had, we skipped right over them.
Oh yes. Well, there's an orb. Yeah, I know. Well, because there's different plot lines. You're saying it's not a B plot, but it's something else. And the first orb scene, I realized it's before the episode starts. Well, and it's also confusing. And I kind of like this because you can't tell exactly what's going on. Then you quickly realize that it's obviously some kind of visiony thing or dream. But it also involves people we don't know, and people, you know, there's like a guy who's hanging there, and Major Kira's playing spring ball. The whole thing is, you know, again, obviously allegory, but it's confusing and upsetting. Right. And so,
yeah. And so Burrell is, he's wandering the promenade on Deep Space Nine. He sees Kira, he looks up, he sees a hanging, a corpse hanging. He lets it down and he says, oh no, it's, I forget what name he uses, but they're
Prylar Beck, which Prylar Beck, I couldn't parse either for a while. Yeah.
And then Kira says, no, it's not. And then you look back and it's Burrell himself. And that's when you know, something's odd about this. And, you know, and to your point, like we have no idea what any of this means.
Yeah, I thought, were we supposed to know who Prylar Beck is? And he looks a little bit like Burrell also, like with the wrapper around the head. So you can't tell. Originally I was like, wait, it's him. No, wait, no, now it's him.
Right. Yes. But it was a little confusing,
but I think it's supposed to unsettle us. And it's that kind of like waking from a cold sweat thing as he closes the doors of the orb box. Chamber. Orb box.
Good old orb box.
Yeah, you can subscribe to the Orb of the Monk box.
That's
right. Send you a profit orb every month.
And mention Random Trek and get 10% off your first order. the dude arrives. Burrell has another orb experience where we see Kai Opaka, you know, heralding the new Kai, who Burrell assumes will be him, but turns out it's Kai Wynn, and he's like, WTF, I don't know what's going on. I don't understand what's going on, and nobody understands what's going on, but then I think Wynn or Opaka give Burrell a snake as a present and tell him that the venom will heal his wounds or something like that.
Right.
We don't know what's going on, so it seems like there's a lot of guilt there with Burrell, but we're not sure why.
It's great too, because that's the original actress who played Kai Opaka, so it's a little bit unsettling too as a viewer. I remember watching this episode in sequence, because I think I was watching everything at that point, and I have this vague recollection. I'm not, my memory isn't that good, but I do have a vague recollection. This is 1994, it aired, of going like, huh, you're like, oh geez. I mean, it has that, it's even dreamier to you as a viewer when somebody who has been gone for like a year and some months at this point off the show, you know, 25 or 30 episodes or whatever, is suddenly there. I mean, they use that effectively in a lot of TV shows, like Twin Peaks, for instance. It puts you in the same place as a viewer as the character almost, because they're like, wait, what the hell are you doing here?
Yes, it's true. So that it is very effective if you remember who Kaio Paka is, which I did, so it was quite effective.
Yeah, that's great. Well, they tell you a bunch of times, too.
So in case remember you don't remember.
Oh, yeah, she's been gone for
a while. She's great. Yep. She's dead. Yep. Oh, yeah.
But Kaio Paka was anointed you. Oh, yeah, that's right. Kaio Paka.
Kaio Paka. We all love Kaio Paka. And so, yeah, this is it. Kobus shows up. There's a great scene where so Wynn is hanging out on Deep Space Nine. We don't really know why. There's a little tension.
We missed the scene. The Cisco scene that I loved happens before this, right? And it doesn't. I'm sorry. I'm the wrong way around.
I was getting to that very scene.
Yep.
Just explaining, people may not remember. So Wynn, there's some tension here because A, you know, people don't trust Wynn. But B, she, in her previous show up on Deep Space Nine, she basically wanted to shut down the school that Keiko O'Brien was running because she refused to teach a Bajoran religion in the class. And so Wynn basically said, well, you're not going to teach any Bajorans then. And they all walked out. So the school shut down. Everybody was upset. And so there's still a little of that simmering behind the scenes. And so she shows up, she goes to Cisco, and she basically says, hey, Cisco, you should, basically come down to the Vedic Assembly with me and say that we're cool. And you could just say that, you like the faith of the Bajoran people, and it'll be great.
And he's like, that's great, but what do we know? But if you don't have a problem with Federation membership, then clearly we should jointly announce it next week.
Mm-hmm.
I just love his expression. He has that kind of pulled back. It's almost not a rictus, but his lips go far back and you see his teeth as he talks. And he's got this intensity that is just, it's anybody else. The two actors together chew up the scenery beautifully because she's doing this underplayed thing. It's all subtext. Everything she says is subtext because none of her words are what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And he is also playing a political game, but he's much more overt. He's not as, he doesn't need to be as good at it at, because he tells the truth all the time.
Right.
So his subtext is almost text, but he gets to be almost laughing at her. She, goes back and forth. She gets his, sort of gets his agreement, but what she really wanted was his neutrality, and she didn't exactly manipulate him, but she got walking out of there is him not denouncing her, which is what she wanted assurance of, even though it appeared as if she wanted an endorsement when she walked in.
Right.
So she had the upper hand.
Exactly. She wanted to make sure that he wouldn't endorse Burrell, and
right.
He basically said, well, it's an internal matter. And at that point, she was like, all right, I'm leaving.
Exactly.
That's you are great. Of no use to me.
That was a beautiful scene.
Yes, and this is that kind of sums up, Wynn as a character. She is operating on many levels, and I think she, much like Gul Dukat, truly believes that whatever she is doing is for the good of her planet and her people, even if it is mostly just for her own good. But she really, really believes that she is being like the most selfless person ever.
Well, or does she, I guess she, I mean, that's the thing is, I don't think she's deluded herself entirely. I think she does, I think there's a clear private-public difference, but one of the things that's really great about Deep Space Nine, so you can talk about this terrifically, is that they give us different viewership positions. So mm-hmm. Sometimes we're really just kind of watching on the outside of what's going on. Sometimes we get access to like private meetings, like this whole episode opens after the teaser, with the very, and by the way, I mean, Vedic, Burrell is really a handsome man. Really. I mean, there's some
we see a lot of Burrell at the beginning of this too. Episode.
He's built. And so, you get this intimate scene with the two of them, which is this privileged position, and the rest of the episode, and we get to see him with his visions, but mm-hmm. The rest of the episode is almost outside. Like that meeting with Wynn and Cisco, we're watching this performance of them to each other, not seeing them talk afterwards to their staff. What they really think. So, and I think different episodes take that differently where you get to see more of that behind the scenes thing of how they're talking about stuff too. So here we're only getting Wynn talking in this earnest way. And most of the time, I think that's true for her character, right? Mm-hmm. She almost never drops that mask. It's only in the later seasons that starts to happen.
And that's what makes her so interesting, right? Because I read that as she actually believes what she is saying to a deep degree. And she also doesn't mind that she gets a lot of power because she, of course, deserves the power because she knows what the right thing to do is. But you can also read it the way you're reading it in that there is at one level she is projecting this, but she also knows internally what she is doing. So there's like levels upon levels. And of course, you know, in later seasons, she just goes off the rails.
Yeah, that's exceptionally cool too, though. Those are the ones I didn't see enough of, and I have to go back and really understand because it's nuts.
It is crazy. So basically Kai Wynn is looking for any way. She knows she's going to lose against Burrell. So she's looking for a way to win, because she thinks that's what the prophets want. So she's just a tool of the prophets, my child. And this guy, Kubus, seems to think that Burrell was involved in this massacre of, a resistance cell, that the Cardassians were tipped off to the location of the cell, and Kaiopaka's son was killed in this raid. And it was long held belief that some other guy and Kubus were the ones behind it, but Kubus says that he didn't have anything to do with it, and he heard Burrell visit the other guy, and through kind of, you know, weak association, just assumes that Burrell has done it. Kira basically says, "You're crazy."
I think Beck confesses in his suicide note, right? I think that's the arrangement.
But Kira's like, "That's crazy pants. I don't believe it." And Wynn, being once again a very clever political animal, says, "This is why I need you to look into this, because I need someone who doesn't want to believe it to make sure that we can find the truth, my child."
So evil and so perfect. When she said that, I'd forgotten that plot point. I was like, "Oh my god, but it's also the interesting thing about it is that Wynn didn't know exactly what was going to play out. She thought it would be to her advantage, mm-hmm. but by putting Kira in that position, I mean, this is very good writing, because by putting Kira in that position, even if it turns out not to be true, then she's like, look, I had someone who actually actively hates me look into this. She discovered this isn't true. Kubus was lying to us all. Thank you, Major Kira.
That's right. Everybody give it up for Major Kira.
Yeah, and it would have rebounded either way to mm-hmm. her benefit.
And so we need to quickly recap. So it turns out, here's the thing. Everybody knows Burrell didn't do it, the viewers, that is, because he's a good-looking guy. He was just nearly half-naked with Kira. Kira wouldn't sleep with a bad dude. And it turns out that, there's a lot of evidence that then points to Burrell. There are messages that are encrypted that only a Vedic could order. Then it turns out, you know, they loop in Quark to break in the encryption, and Quark breaks it, but everything's been deleted. Then they loop in, and this is like, you know, Kira's kind of sneaking around, but this is like the worst conspiracy ever, because she loops in everybody. And she goes to O'Brien and is like, these files were deleted. Can you recover them? And he's like, well, there's not enough to recover it, but I can, for some reason, recover the retinal scan. So
that was actually, I got to say, that was actually way ahead of its time, because there's a lot of evidence now about in image processing about with very, very limited information, as long as it's unique enough, mm-hmm. you can recover entire images. Oh, so I saw that and I was like, man, the research behind that was 20 years later, and kind of like, I've seen demonstrations that are like, I've got like 15 pixels in this image and we recover a picture of Barack Obama. So was not as ridiculous as
well,
it would have seen.
There you go. I do this. And that moment, that has my favorite moment in the entire episode, because Chief O'Brien, who I love, manages to recover the retinal print. And then the interface, for some reason, turns into the eye, and then it zooms out to reveal the face. And I thought,
that was great.
That is a great piece of a TV, but B, like the worst interface ever.
That's right. I'd like, yeah. Well, you know, we took a 1 terabyte picture of the person's face, and then we just take the image part of the eye, but we keep the whole thing there.
We keep the whole thing. Just, you know, we have a lot of space, so it doesn't matter.
Also good to know that even in the future, retinal biometrics are apparently the best, highest level thing you can do.
So. It is good. And now it looks like, oh boy, Burrell is guilty. And, you know, Kira is not – subtlety is perhaps not Major Kira's middle name. So she's like, I got to go talk to Burrell. So she peeps down. She basically says, hey, Burrell, you're the one that did this. And he is pained and he doesn't want to say anything, and I think he drops out of the race, right? So then Kai Wynn wins, and she becomes Kai, and Kira's like, WTF, man, it's clear to me that you are guilty. And he's very pained, but he explains, no, I wasn't guilty. Kaiopaka, in fact, is the one who shared the information with the Cardassians that led to the death of this cell.
Well, she extracts it out of him, right? She realizes this is one of those great moments where she's, through inference, she's like, wait a minute, this all doesn't come together correctly. Now I understand.
Yeah.
And he was trying to, and which is a wonderful bit, because then he gets to be, he's been noble. Kaiopaka turns out to be flawed. She made a moral judgment that was, it was so terrible that her son was killed, but she did it to ostensibly save, 1,200 right. people and give up 42. It's like one of these ultimate moral choices you
That's
make.
Right. Unless you're a Vulcan. And then the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. So it's,
it's very simple. Right. Exactly. Vulcan's like, kill the child will die. That's fine. We'll move on from there. Exactly. But yeah, so it's, I think it's a wonderful example. So Kaiopaka, who everyone's extolled, now she's has feet of clay, even though, that makes you reevaluate. Well, maybe she did make the right decision, because if she hadn't made that decision, then 1,200 people would have died.
Right.
But then Vedic Burrell, even though Wynn has become the Kai, he is no longer flawed in the same way. He was keeping the right secret instead of protecting himself. And then we get to think about all the visions throughout. We're like, oh, of course. Like, he was guilty about
keeping that secret.
Yeah, he was conflicted about what Kaiopaka had done and protecting Kaiopaka rather than protecting himself. And that's why he fought so hard against it, wouldn't admit it.
And I don't think – and he was, on another level, he wasn't just protecting Kaiopaka, but given the fact that the Bajorans are in such a gentle, fragile state, and Kaiopaka is like this – the revered person, having yet another thing taken away from the Bajoran people, I think would have been a bad thing, right? So he is like, I can't tell anybody this because it'll do a lot of harm, and so it will just rest with me. And Kai Wynn will be Wynn and will be, the Kai, but I'll be around and I'll be her advisor, because clearly she's going to need a lot of help, which is true. Although, spoiler alert, well, I won't say anything, because if you're watching in order, I don't want to ruin what happens. But
I've forgotten what happens.
I won't tell you.
See? Oh, good. Please don't. I will learn. Don't tell me, because my brain has forgotten the facts.
And this is what then, it ends with this thing of – Kira is upset because Burrell has lied to her, and Wynn is now Kai, and she hates Wynn, rightly so. And she's worried about where Wynn is going to lead her, because there's this unstable megalomaniac in charge now. I don't know where, echoes of perhaps current political landscape. I don't know. Depending on your views, perhaps.
Well, they were trying, Major Kira was just trying to recover the missing emails, right?
That is true. She just wanted to find the truth.
Yeah.
And I guess O'Brien, that makes Quark a Ferengi hacker. Is that right?
Oh my gosh. This goes deeper than I ever would have thought. They not only predicted image recovery technology, but also the election.
But then, Kira is very upset. And Burrell, who, Kira and Burrell are in a relationship. They clearly love each other. And Burrell's like, well, where does this – I think Kira says, where does this leave us? And Burrell basically says, well, where do you want it? Where do you want it to leave us? And they end kissing, and they walk off to pay their respects to the new Kai, living happily ever after.
Yes, nothing bad ever happens again in the whole show.
This is Deep Space Nine ends here. Everybody's happy. And it turns out Kai Wynn is a great administrator and does a lot of great good for the people of Bajor.
Of course. And everyone lives happily after.
That's right. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for joining me.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for the random method of creating episode choices for picking this episode for me. Thank you.